Yeah, don't count your chips. Okay, here we go. It's good to be back in the Beit Midrash with everybody for our study in Talmud Pesachim in chapter 10. And as promised, we're turning to the next Mishnah because we've done now the first one. We've talked about wine. We've talked about Kiddush. We've talked about Kiddush for Yontif as a separate kind of experience from that of Shabbat and Havdalah, but we've lumped it all together in order to say that we're talking about great celebrations here. But this chapter particularly made sure to tell us that even the poorest among everyone in Israel has to have 4 cups of wine. Tzedakah Fund has to support everybody in order to make sure that that happens. And we reserve the right to go back and look into some of the pages between 102 and 114 that we're going to skip to now to get to the second Mishnah of the chapter. So, you know, it's not like we're completely passing them by without noticing all the good stuff that we could have touched upon. And we might just go back a couple of pages here and there to see where they connect. But I want to jump into this next Mishnah on 114a1, where actually 2 Mishnayot in the chapter appear. And this is the Seder experience now come to life. And so we're going to talk about the Seder experience. I don't have to have us go through the brainstorm, I don't think, of, you know, kind of thinking about Seder supplies, but just to put it out there, think about that which you would need if you were making a Seder. Have in mind now all of the supply that you would need. And I know that we can name a lot. But I want to ask you this question quickly, and first thing that comes to mind. If I said you need bitter herbs, what's the first thing you have in mind for bitter herbs that we need for Pesach?
We tend to use horseradish.
Horseradish, right? Horseradish. That's the first thing. So just keeping that in mind, important for us Ashkenazic, most of us, I think everybody here, Ashkenazic Jews, that's what comes to mind first. Second point that we've made before, because of our knowledge of the ancient world, that when the Mishnah says they mixed him a cup, we're talking about that ancient kind of wine that requires water within the heavy mead-like substance, which is not beer, but wine, syrupy wine, that requires one to pour it with water and to drink it that way. Okay, so Mishnah on 114a1, here we go. The Tana is now going to start telling you, here are the stages of the Seder, here's how you're going to make a Seder. Mazgulo kos rishon. They mix and pour for him the first cup of wine. We've established that indeed the 4 cups are really here to be blessed throughout the Seder experience, at least thus far. We know that they are attached to 4 languages of redemption. So, Beit Shammai Omrim, Beit Shammai is going to tell us, Mivarech al Hayom, va'achar kach mivarech al hayayin, that the way you ought to make Kiddush is start with the Kiddush blessing, that is the blessing that is for Pesach. Shebach Rabbanu Mikolam, you know, that one, and then say Borei Pri HaGafen. So that's Beit Shammai's position. Beit Hillel, because if Beit Shammai has an opinion, Beit Hillel has to have an opinion. Omrim mivarech al hayayin, first you bless over the wine, v'achar kach mivarech al hayom, and afterwards you bless on the day. Now, which way do we say Kiddush? Beit Hillel, right?
No, we do the blessing and then the Kiddush.
do Shammai, don't we?
We do Shammai, right?
Yeah, Shammai.
No, 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 wait. Listen. Beit Hillel says, first you say Borei Pri HaGafen, then you say the big blessing that has the Kiddushat Hayom.
We do it the other way. Right, that's Hillel.
No, wait. If I'm starting with the Kiddushat Friday night, what's my first blessing? The Kiddushat Hayom or the Yayin, Borei Pri HaGafen?
Yayin. Yom HaShishi.
Ah, Yom HaShishi, you're thinking maybe that's the Kiddushat Hayom.
Yeah.
That's an added paragraph. That's an added paragraph of the biblical psukim of the verses that were added so that you understood the context of the experience of Kiddush.
So which part?
The actual Kiddush on a Friday night is, without saying which order for a minute, the blessing over the cup of wine itself that I'm using, and the larger blessing that says, today is Shabbat, and it's in remembrance of the going out of Egypt as much as it's in the remembrance of the creation of the world.
So what's that in Hebrew?
Borei Pri HaGafen, Yayin.
Yeah, and
then that other blessing is called the Kiddushat Hayom, not the Vayechulu part.
Okay.
You don't actually drink the wine until...
You don't drink it, that's for sure. So you don't actually, what's called Over La'afiyata, go directly to the performance of the mitzvah that you blessed. Perhaps Beit Shammai's reasoning that he wants you to say the Borei Pri HaGafen after the long paragraph is because he feels, like you're mentioning now, that if I say Borei Pri HaGafen, I ought to drink this wine immediately. And I'm not clear why I can say a blessing, what's called Shel Nehenim, meaning that I'm going to gain enjoyment out of this physical substance. How could I say that at the beginning and then launch into this whole long paragraph? Right? That's one possibility of why he says that. Hillel says, start with Borei Pri HaGafen and then say the Kiddush. So if I look in several Haggadot, which I've put tonight so we can look at different things, and I turn and I open to Kiddush, the first blessing that I'm going to see is Borei Pri HaGafen, which is called Birkat HaYayin, and that's what Hillel says, say first. And then I turn the page, and I have the blessing that's Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Bachavanu Mikol Am, Varamamanu Mikol Lashon, V'Kiddushanu B'Mitzvotav, V'Titen Lanu Hashem Elokeinu B'Ahava. Right? Moedim l'simcha, chagim u'zmanim l'sason, et yom chag ha-matzot hazeh, zman cheruteinu, mikra kodesh zecher litziyat mitzrayim. That's the Kiddushat Hayom. So Hillel says, Borei Pri HaGafen, then Kiddushat Hayom. That's the way it's set up in the Haggadah, and that's the way it's set up in all of our Haggadahs.
But again, we don't drink until...
We don't drink until after, right?
So they're really one.
They are a unit. You're saying the Kiddushat Hayom, the blessing of the day, over this cup of wine, just for purposes of English translation, over this cup of wine. So what is another possibility of, the, you know, for Shammai reasoning that first you ought to say the Kiddushat Hayom, the big blessing about you chose us, God, and you brought us out of Egypt, and you gave us this festival of matzah, and etc., and then to say Borei Pri HaGafen, that's one of the issues the Gemara is going to deal with. So there's a shita here, there's a kavate, there's according to his system thought that's going to come out of the argumentation. There's also going to be a principle that we learn in the Gemara now about why Hillel holds the way he holds, that you say Borei Pri HaGafen. No one really relates to the question in this section as to why you can delay the drinking, but there is some thought in the Gemara that this day establishes, and this will come out here a little bit, this day establishes that you may use this wine as a symbolic way of saying this day has a certain amount of, let's say, ascension within it, kedusha within it, a holiness factor, like wine, is Yisamach, is one of the vehicles that gladdens the heart of humanity. This so too this day of Yontif, this holiday day. So listen to the way the Gemara now is going to let this conversation unfold. Tanu Rabbanan, we have a braita. Devarim shebein Beit Shammai uvein Hillel besuda. There are matters of dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel relating to meals. And now let me give you some of those matters that they debated about. Beit Shammai omrim, Beit Shammai says, Mivarech al hayom, first you should really say the blessing that is particular to the holiday itself, that part of Kiddush, which is really particular to the Yontif. V'achar kach mivarech al hayayin, and then say your berei pri hagafen part. Mipnei shehayom gorem l'yayin sheyavo. Because the day itself, the holiday, is what causes you to raise that glass of wine and use it as a symbolic tool or vessel for holiness. Uchavar kidesh hayom v'adayan Yayin lova, and because the day has already been sanctified, and the wine has not yet come to the table. So I have two reasons. First of all, the wine itself is only a symbolic vehicle through which I sanctify the day if I have pronounced the blessing to sanctify the day. A. B. Since I have a Mishnah that says they mixed and poured for him that first cup, and I, in Beit Shammai's outlook about how the Seder might have unfolded, and I expect that he would have started sanctifying the day, and then they pour him the wine, then, of course, he's sanctified the day, he said that part of the Seder, and then he gets the wine in hand, he says Berei Pri Hagafen, and he drinks it. That's not, quote-unquote, normal by way of how we understand Kiddush, but perhaps that's the way the Gemara is presenting Shammai's thinking for the Seder night, at least. Could it be possible in the ritual of the Seder that you start by sitting down at your small, remember, you're reclining on this little thing, you have a space in front of you, you're kind of in this arrangement of a you, a chet, and perhaps the first act is to sing some or chant some or state some liturgy. In this case, that liturgy sounds ultimately familiar to other Yontif Kiddushim, to other Yontif Kiddushes. But in this case, because it's Pesach, where we do have a little bit of a reorchestration of what the meal experience is really feeling like, looking like, as they unfold, as this banquet unfolds, we bring things out, we take things away, that's all part of what's going to be in here and that we're going to see. Maybe, in fact, he starts with that liturgy and then they pour him the cup and he says Berei Pri Hagafen. Maybe it's in contradistinction to what happens with other holidays on purpose. In order to what? We're going to get the statement a couple of pages away, a couple of passages away, that we do a lot of things with a little bit of a twist in order to what? Create a night full of questions. To engage the children. And to create a night full of questions, not only for the children, but for everyone present. You could go that far and interpret this spot, I think, that far, given the cultural reality of the development of the Seder within the Mishnaic period at this point. Because now we're going to turn to a whole different reason, Devar Acher. Right? So, Beit Hillel says, just to finish up that first thought though, Mevarech al Yayin, one recites the blessing over the wine, Borei Pri HaGafen, before the other longer passage of Kiddush, V'achar kach Mevarech al Yom, and you say the big Asher B'charbanu Mikol Am, the larger part of Kiddush that mentions the festival of Matzah, for this principle in Jewish law, Mipnei Shehayayin Gorem Lakidush, that the wine causes the sanctification blessing to be said, Sheteyamer, that you need the Borei Pri HaGafen like a key to say, now I am sanctifying this day over this instrument of sanctification, over this symbolic cup of wine. So does, for Hillel, the wine act as kind of the key that you put in the gate? The gate opens up, and then you say Kiddush? Now, that's the halachic principle he's invoking. You need something physical and of this world to make for the moment where you can state definitively with liturgy that this holiday is beginning, that this moment is the moment that creates the space for memory, that we're basically seeing the physical symbol as bringing the holiday into our physical world? Is that going philosophically too far? Is Hill simply saying, I have a formula for the way we make sanctification blessings? Because we say, Borei Pri HaGafen, and that allows us, it permits us to say the bigger Kiddush, the bigger paragraph of Kiddush that comes afterwards. I mean, it seems like the language of the wine gorem l'kiddush sh'teyamer causes the Kiddush paragraph to be said. There's something in that language.
It's problematic.
I'm saying that if it's
it presupposes that there's a logic there that we accept because that's what we do, but
yeah, there's like a cause and effect, right? That wine opens it up. So I don't know if it's problematic, but it definitely is something that causes it or that pushes it in, or that is used, as I was saying, like a key that creates the space for this other blessing to be said.
How about necessitate the day, the somberness of the day necessitates the wine to come?
Well, there's no somberness.
Somberness, whatever the wrong word, but necessity, the
solemnity. Oh, the solemnity.
Solemnity, right.
The importance.
Importance necessitates the wine.
Okay, so maybe for Beit Shammai, you mean?
No, I'm looking the word gorem, just the word.
Just the word gorem.
Because in modern Hebrew, gorem is a cause, but maybe they didn't mean it as causing.
No, they meant causing because they know grammar. They have there's a principle, mitzvot ase shezaman grama. This time, this moment, causes this mitzvah to really, this time creates the obligation for this mitzvah. Yeah.
So, you have the image of opening it up. The image I have is separation. I think Judaism really likes to keep things compartmentalized. We do it in the service by having different sections and we introduce them and end them with, we like everybody to know when we're moving from one to another.
Mm-hmm.
And because Kiddush is the blessing over wine has this transition of going from everyday life to a solemn occasion that we're used to, and therefore that reaction puts everybody in the right frame of mind in order to be able to invoke the holiness of the day in that spirit.
Mm-hmm. Great. Hold that thought, Barry, because if they didn't say that explicitly here, they're wanting you to get to that sense of maybe this Kiddush unlocks a certain amount of conscious participation and a certain what will be called kavana, right? So that's what you're describing. Yes, I think that's a great image. Separation could be possible because we're big into separations. You're right.
Yeah, we like.
You're like. You're right. We're big into them. I guess I see the gate as the gates of it all, because I'm using the imagery of the gates of prayer, you know, Sha'arei Ne'ilah, the gates of Ne'ilah, you know, these gates that I oftentimes think about when we go through and we say blessings that have a certain intentionality behind them. But I agree with you.
It's more poetic, but I think mine relates to how people, they go from here, but they need to have that definition.
Right.
It's also practical, and that's sort of like the key, but also, if you say the blessing for the day, and you don't have wine, you're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
This is a holy day because of the wine, but we don't have wine. If you do it the other way, you never end up in that situation because you have the wine, or you say the blessing.
Because there seems to be a fundamental factual dispute between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, because Shammai's saying the wine hasn't come to the table yet,
right?
So we're not ready to say the wine blessing, whereas Beit Hillel says the wine is already sitting here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So if you need to have the wine to be able to, you know, as Fred was saying, you know, to be able to do the sanctification of the day, then it's got to be on the table, and somehow there seems to be a factual distinction here.
I mean, I was really pushing that as a possible way of reading the Mishnah, that Beit Shammai believes that you could have started the Pesach Seder without the wine around. It doesn't say that, just to be clean with that, it doesn't say that explicitly in the Gemara.
Right.
Neither Rashi nor Rashbam says that. It's hinted at in is it hinted at in the notes, or am I really reading creatively?
Well, because they note that, you know, in like June 13, it says, you know, Rashi and Rashbam note that the dispute occurs even when, due to a lack of wine, you have to recite Kiddush over Matzah. I mean, which seems to suggest you have to have you have to have something there to be able to recite.
Yes.
So if you don't have it there.
Yeah, I think that I'm reading, though, somewhat creatively, and I'm not going to take full credit for it. I think it's in one of the texts that I was learning, or one of the Haggadot that I was studying. But I really am intrigued by this idea that the Seder just wasn't completely organized in the way that, you know, this book or this book says to make a Seder. And it could be that at this point the Mazgula Kos Rishon was happening. I see Beit Shammai saying, no, I've been to a Seder. I've been to the Seder where he started saying the blessing first, and then they brought the wine to the table. You know, Rashi and Rashbam about that note 13, arguing over whether or not he can make Kiddush on the matzah. You know, that's kind of an interesting reality of kind of back to Fred, what you were saying, that you need something, and you don't want to get in a situation where you're making a wrong blessing, like you're wondering if they're going to bring it, and you made the wrong blessing. There's halacha about what you do when, from the get-go, you don't know what you don't have wine, but you only have matzah. For Shabbat, you only have challah. And what process you use to make kiddush over that one item. That to me seems like a different issue than the possibility that Shammai is saying for Seder night. Start by saying the bigger kiddush, even if regularly you start with yayin or a pri guffin, or in a case where you don't have wine, go with the bread or the matzah. And it's just possible. It's just possible that that's the kind of Seder custom that Shammai is pushing in terms of the Pesach experience, which is, to me, really compatible with a lot of the questions we're going to have reading the next Mishnah in terms of how is this really orchestrated?
It's kind of like popping the clutch, jumping the, starting in second, not in first.
Yeah,
if
yeah.
You remember.
Definitely. Wait, does that only work downhill?
I think you have to be moving.
Yeah, you have to be moving a little. You either need a couple of people to help push it out, but I think it's an interesting piece. Hillel seems to be going with a little bit more of let's use accepted norms for the kiddush. Shammai might be saying, oh, I see it a little differently here because the tradition is Mazgulo Kos Rishon. They mixed him up this first cup of wine. Maybe they're doing that right at the table while he's saying this other liturgy. Again, that's imaginative.
So as we're talking about how they might have run things, I was just kind of struck by the fact that there's some they. So the person who conducts this, why couldn't that person mix wine and pour wine? Is the person who's doing it doesn't actually make the physical preparation? Is there someone else that's kind of serving?
Note number 9 says that.
Read it out loud, Barry.
So note number 9, so somebody else is doing it for the person who's actually conducting the service. The source for the custom that others pour the wine to the head of the household as a symbol of freedom.
Yeah. So, A, there's that note that says others pour the wine for the head of the household. B, I'll just share, as I have at Siddarim here in the synagogue, at the congregational Seder, we pour each other's wine. So not just for the head of the household, but as a sign of freedom, we pour each other's wine. What's the sign of freedom, though, that we're really hearkening back to? In the pages that I told you that we were totally skipping, with permission to just, find the couple of things that we want to mention, it will, at one point, talk about who's required to recline, right? And in the discussion of who's required to recline, you will see that the question of whether or not the waiters have to recline comes up. And so as this kind of sign of freedom, you somehow have this group of people who are your waiters. That's a really good question. Because women, I'll just read this, Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, this is on page 108, we don't have to turn there, Nashim chayavot ba'arba'a kosot halavim. Women are required for these four cups. She'af hen hayu ba'oto anes. They were in the same miracle. And then there's a discussion about, them being in the same miracle. And so, and it also says, afilu oni shav Yisrael lo yochal ad she'yasev. And the poorest of the poor have to recline. And the Gemara says at one point that a woman who's with her husband is not required to recline. And we were in the house of my master, and there was not enough room for everyone to recline, so we reclined on each other's knees. A person must recline in the presence of anyone. And how about, what's the halacha with regard to a waiter? Tashma, the Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, Hashamash she'achal kazait matzah shehu may save, yatza. Come in here, Rabbi Yehoshua said, a waiter who ate an olive bulk of matzah while reclining has fulfilled the obligation. So obviously, there was a someone who, you know, just got did enough of the mitzvahs while he was serving, and the Gemara infers there that if he ate matzah while reclining, that he's really fulfilled the obligation, and if he was not, lo yatsa, he needed to lean. So in other words, it's a waiter, but it's someone who also participates with you in the meal. And this is kind of like what happens sometimes on Shabbat with our Shabbat meals. We hire Irwin to be our mashgiach, but we have a place for him. So he does a lot of work down in the kitchen, but he also has to hear Kiddush. And he also has to make a motzi on two challahs. So we have to be attentive to those we hire to do certain roles within our community, to have them actually participate with us at the very least for the things that they have to fulfill in terms of positive obligations for mitzvot.
My question has to do with how women will participate in the preparations for the Seder.
Well, as I read here, they go to the notion of Nashim Chayavot, and that they were really obligated to be reclining here, and that they were really obligated within the whole mitzvah structure.
So would waiters be male or female?
So I think that with the language here, it's male. I really do. And with Nashim, just to pick up on your question, since you asked, She'af hen hayu ba'oto anes, they were there. Rashi and Rashbam, over on that spot, on the couple of pages before this Mishnah that we're reading now, will explain that even though we're talking about mitzvot shehazaman grama, they'll categorize it as mitzvot that come because they are time-bound, meaning at this time one must perform this positive obligation, and usually women are exempt from that category of mitzvah. In fact, women are obligated. And I'll just say, in the ultra-Orthodox community where I spent a couple of years, even though you might not set up your home the same way these two distinct and separate rooms were set up, one for the men and one for the women,
for the Seder,
the men had a Seder here, and the women had a Seder here. They for sure left Egypt together, and it sounds as though, within the realities of the pages of Gemara, that everybody's celebrating together, especially because it makes the point. Tosafot disagree and maintain women are included in the obligation because they were in equal danger as the men, not that they were in the same miracle as the men. So they just have a little bit of a discussion that way. And some commentaries explain that women experienced unusual suffering in Egypt because the Egyptians forced men to perform women's labors and women to do tasks suited to men. In addition, the Egyptians threw newborn babies into the Nile, which caused exceptional grief. So that there's a unique exploration of the emotional tie of women to this experience of redemption. And therefore, there really needed to be some experience. No one's written the history textually of how women participated and what women were to do and how they functioned. You can bet that women were probably involved more in the preparations for the Seder than the men, right? Except to say that what we forget sometimes is that there's halacha and code about men participating in Sidurei Abayit, in getting the household ready, in making sure you've got the right supplies. Men are required, according to the Gemara on these pages, again, that we're just kind of sailing through to get where we are tonight, to make sure that the household has wine, because he's responsible for Simcha and Yantiv, and wine becomes, in place of meat at the Beit HaMikdash, that which really is the symbol of Simcha, the symbol of joy, in those pages of Gemara. So I think that this time of year was a time that men and women took on various obligations. So much, as we know, there needed to be a fuller participation of you know, both parts of the household. Jay, then Ari.
I want to follow up on what you proposed about the possibility that Beit Shammai is saying this only to make...
Oh, good, good.
...that it's different because, do I understand correctly that there is no discussion elsewhere in the Gemara about the order of these two, for instance, for Shabbat?
Not the very first...
So this is the only place it's discussed. So is Beit Shammai then deliberately ignoring the principle that you would first say the bracha that's more common?
Ah, so that's going to be the Devar Acher. That's going to now come. Jay's bringing up another principle that the Gemara is going to deal with in terms of giving us some instruction as to how we prioritize which blessing would go first. But that Devar Acher hasn't come yet.
Right, but that's my question. Is that an accepted principle already, and do we have any evidence that Beit Shammai doesn't hold to that in other cases? In which case, this would be an exception.
I don't have evidence from anywhere that Beit Shammai holds like that in other cases, that I can uproot the second principle that we've yet to say aloud, which is this principle of that which comes more often, you do first, and that which comes less often, you do secondly. So no, I don't have anywhere where he's uprooting that principle. And two...
No, what I mean is that an accepted principle already?
Two, because it exists in this Braita,
right,
and in other places, then I have to imagine that he knows full well the halachic parlance or the halachic principle. And this part of the Braita doesn't relate to that. I have to separate it out because of the Devar Acher. The Devar Acher might have been someone else teaching the tradition in their name or other students' understandings when he gave a different lecture at a different time. Yeah, let's look at that now, where that comes up. And, oh yeah, we, all right.
Do they actually have separate rooms where men and women? I've never heard that before. That's like came out of nowhere. So
like
who leads the Haggadah in the women's section?
That's probably a modern ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah.
Is it literally...
I have to say that it's got to be a modern ultra-Orthodox. It's also a matter of space. There are so many children and so many relatives in this household that the men literally fill up the room that they have, where the table is usually set, and then they create Pesach space in this... It's not really exile. The women were in the kitchen. But it's not really exile. The women were in the kitchen, and they take...
Of course in the kitchen.
But it's not like it's a shoe with the women are upstairs.
With due respect, I think we're really kind of judging this community's sense of space that they're creating for the pursuit of these mitzvot, and making the space for women at that time is essential and important. If they simply were creating the same Ezrat Nashim and now saying about the Seder, which women were participating in, you no longer have the right to participate in this because we only have room for the men here, that would be one thing. But I do believe that in terms of the occasion, there was a massive amount of men and women working together to get this night really set, and all people involved with eating the right amounts of matzah and the right amounts of bitter herbs and all the mitzvot that needed to be performed. So in terms of leadership, there's not leadership at these sedarim like you would imagine at what we experience as seders. Though there is a head of a household who ultimately will, in this household, by the way, is Iraqi guy who adopted the Moroccan custom of coming to pass the Seder plate, which is a three-tiered Seder plate with all the items on top, passing it above your head and giving you a blessing specific to each person. It takes such a long time. He did it both for the men and the women and individualized the blessings at the Seder. Unbelievable. They went to 2:30, 2:45 in the morning for this whole script. But the leadership is not like a leadership that we imagine. People are reciting the Haggadah as if it's like the scene of, imagine a Beit Midrash, where people's voices are rising, 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 and finally when the leader is done with that section, that's the cue to move on to the next section. Someone might, according in that culture, someone might bring up in the space that's like this much, that division between one step and the next, someone might bring up a question or a Gemara or halakha or some matter of law or some point they want to make. But depending on whether or not the conversation stops or the leader moves on and everybody starts in with the liturgy, then there's a moment, though, where there's something that's done in such a way that really creates space for the kids to get a little confused, or by orchestration for them to come and ask questions, but not with, you know, plastic frogs or bugs or some of these new kind of ways that someone inserts a song that came from a verse in Shir HaShirim that mentions one kind of item that you might have on the Seder plate, and they go and they are told to find the item that this verse hints you into, and they're sent on searches. Just by way of the culture, it's just a different level of engagement, and it's a different kind of engagement and literacy. You know, so I mean, I, by the way, I didn't see what happens, and you could very well be right that women are relegated to places where they ought not to in some of the communities that are out there, or some of the yeshivot, right? There are those spaces in modernity where we really are trying to see that, you know, not just equality and respect happens for men and women around the Seder table, but in other mitzvot as well, where they weren't written, women weren't written into the picture as definitively and explicitly as this. This principle of uprooting mitzvot shezaman grama, of uprooting the principle that women are exempt for mitzvot that are time-bound, but not for Pesach, even though it's time-bound, has led to some uprooting the principle of keeping women out of other mitzvot. So we're going to... This is a precedent builder. Among other times when women were exempted from being exempt. In other words, the rabbinic logic is that women were exempted from being exempt. That's turned into now a positive. Well, we can, of course, say that even though it's a time-bound mitzvah, women are obviously not exempted or excluded from every one of those mitzvot. So let's now include them, or even obligate them, or allow women to take on the obligation. And by the way, that's not philosophically agreed upon at this point. Include them, exempt them from the exemption, or have women themselves take on the obligation and thus become entirely obligated.
Is there a difference between inclusion and obligation?
Very much.
How would this apply here?
How does it what?
How would this apply, like, in this particular case?
In what particular
case?
In
this particular, what you're referring to.
Well, here, they are entirely obligated to the four cups. Right? Because hen hayu ba'oto hanes. They're obligated. And so, in tefillah, for instance, though, if you ask, how does it work? Right? What if a woman walked into Or Zeruah and said, I don't count myself in a minyan? Is it that woman's prerogative to say that and therefore not be counted in a minyan? Or does our inclusion override that personal kavana, personal intentionality?
Yeah, of course, community rules.
So you would say community rules. What would you say?
She had the option not to come in.
She would have to walk out of the room.
She would never come. this could happen only the other way around. What if a woman walked into an Orthodox and said, I am counting, but otherwise she would not come to Ozarua in order to take something away from herself. So I don't think it's not
she
a
could
well
be here. She could come with someone else.
I've had the other
Wait. Hold on a second. Hold it. Could it happen, Meira?
Sure.
Well, I can have an example. You know Adina, right?
Yeah.
I was Adina, my friend, the one who made the parochet and all that.
Yes.
Long time ago, when I discovered Ozarua through Adina, because she made the parochet, and then she told me about Ozarua, and I came over, and the rest is history. So I was telling you about my participation, and especially because I'm a lady, then I have Aliyah, and Adina, who is just as traditional and loving the religion as myself and all that, she said to me, that I could never do. I can never see myself doing Aliyah. Adina, we grew up in the same culture, same egalitarian thinking, everything the same, but somehow that Orthodox, more traditional approach is so ingrained in her from childhood, whatever, more than in me. These are her words. She said, I cannot see myself. That's an example. Mm-hmm. She would not probably
That's a real example we have here. We have females who are by Kohen. And when we don't have another Kohen here, we would never dream of forcing them to take the Aliyah, even though it impacts the rest of the congregation and the way the entire service unfolds. Well, not the whole service. But I'm saying that we respect that woman has the right to come in here and exert her own identity. She's not forced. We don't assimilate her into the collective.
Yeah. No, we don't enforce anything. But I'm saying, is it a likely situation?
We have a bunch. Charlie, what was your scenario?
Scenario was an egalitarian minion of the Shiva. Tenth person was an Orthodox man, and he walked out of the room so that there would not be a minion.
Okay, so that is for people who don't count themselves, and that is the next piece of this, right, when it comes to whether or not a man would choose to include himself or not in a minion that's shivyoni. We use the term shivyoni in Hebrew for a minion that makes or creates equality between men and women, counting towards the minion. So there are many men who I've been traveling with because of multi-movement kind of trips around the globe, who would step out and choose to daven personally versus make a mixed minion.
So a woman can do the same thing then?
Yeah. If we're talking about where the woman's there, you're talking about a situation where somebody left the room that's no longer a minion.
Right. My scenario was a little different, but it's true that individual consciousness plays into this.
Right. But if she was a tenth person who showed up in the morning, you would say, one is Kaddish, she wouldn't have the privilege of changing our tradition because we are a community, and she has to.
That's the question.
I think that
she doesn't have to go up for the Aliyah because that's the choice, but she can't tell us we can't count her.
Right. I think that I'm.
She's there.
Right. So let's put a different scenario. I'll give you a different twist. A bat mitzvah family has relatives coming, and they have some relatives who don't count themselves in a minyan. Women who are knowledgeable, practicing Jews who don't count themselves in a minyan. They're not even Orthodox. For the scenario, they come from conservative synagogues, only a few left, where only men count to the minyan. They're quite fine with that, and they make it known beforehand that they can't be counted in a minyan. Please don't count me.
You don't have a minyan.
And we have 10 people in the room after Mizmor Shir Chanukah to Beit LeDavid, after the first psalm for Pesukei Zimra. And now we have a Kaddish. So the question is whether or not, at that point, the Shaliach Tzibur, the person leading the service, should simply just roll right into Kaddish?
Absolutely. They're on Ozarua ground. They're not in their home ground.
No, I don't think you can make people
you shouldn't make them go up for an aliyah, but the fact is, the minute they're here under our rules are if there's a person there, whether they're female or male, that's 10 people.
By the way, I think it doesn't make any difference whether the person is male or female. The situation Charlie described, it's exactly the same thing. You have the person there.
It isn't because he left.
If the woman left, she can even be counted.
If she picked herself up,
If she's not necessary to constitute the minion, it doesn't make any difference whether if you have a room with 100 people and there's 50 men and 50 women, and there are a bunch of women who don't want to be counted in a minion, it doesn't make any difference.
But the question is, do we respect her wishes, or do we say she has to subrogate her wishes to ours? So I'm asking you, what do you do?
We're still
part of this community versus individual. For example, let's assume there are only 7 people there. I think we have consensus here that no, you need 10 people, absolutely.
Right.
Suppose the person leading that says, "Well, as long as we want to say it, there's 7 people, I'm going to go ahead and say it." People on their own can choose to leave because they don't accept it as part of community you're visiting,
or not say the cottage,
whatever they choose to do, or they can say, "I am in someone else's community. This is their tradition. I don't believe it. I don't feel it in my heart. But if they choose to do this, I will just ignore it and stay here." We have a situation, this family where honoring the mother and father occasionally comes up against pretty obvious halakha. So, what do you do? It's an individual choice. And again, sort of community individual, which are some of the very difficult decisions because there are no real clear lines. Mm. But in most of these cases, the individual has the option to leave. Mm. The community has the choice to proceed. And that's sort of what you do, and the people make their own choices. A few cases where the woman or man leaves. And they say, "We don't have 10 people, we can't say it." Okay. Others, they say, "We're just going to go ahead." Person may have to say cottage. They say, "I don't think there are 10 people here. I'm not going to stand up and say it."
Hmm.
That's their choice, individually. Hmm. Or they can say, "I'm going to stand up and say it to accept in this community, but I'd never choose to do this on my own." Hmm. That's sort of
right.
That's my lack of faith.
Right.
Gray.
Do you want to finish?
How about for people who the question always comes up about whether or not, like if someone's sitting in the service playing with their cell phone. Are they part of the minion? So isn't that the same thing? If they don't have their heart in it, their soul in it, or whatever you're supposed to have in it when you're praying?
Here it's a little different.
Sitting there.
Here it's a little different. Here we're talking about the specific and distinct issue of male-female participation. That as a reality...
It's the same thing.
That would disqualify... many, many people from participating in the service. Many, many people. And so what we live with is a very antinomian reality and acceptance of Jews and giving them opportunities to do mitzvot, even though they're not all the way, let's say, doing every part of the observance of Shabbat, for instance, that we require. Alex, did you want to say something?
No, I'm just saying that if you're in a group that's going to wait until the 10 they need, then the answer is you wait a long time until the 10th person comes.
Right.
There's someone
that's right. So I'll answer the question like this. I've only had one instance at Orzarua. Where a family really had a group of Orthodox relatives who were coming, who made it very clear to me that until a minion of males would be there, that please, we wouldn't want to say Kaddish or be counted or participate.
Yeah.
I asked them to exercise their free will outside of, just not coming in at all. If they were here and they looked around and they knew that we were going to have a minion of 10, they were free to excuse themselves and leave me without one. But that in our sanctuary, everyone is counted towards the minion if you're Jewish. And so it was a way to kind of give them the responsibility of either adding with their physical presence or taking away from the group of people who were in the room, how then we as decisors, right, as the decisor, the community as the decisor, or you want to take it as a rabbinic decision to say we are a minion of equals. Not everyone's obligated to be equal in the same way, though, by way of individual mitzvot. And if you notice what we have experience with in our minyanim, so let's take during the week, not everyone is required to lay tefillin, right? Men and women, men can even be considered to being on their way towards the mitzvah, like women are being on, perhaps regarded as on their way towards the mitzvah, if you believe that women are obligated to lay tefillin just like men. But if you believe that women have the conscious decision to take on the mitzvah of tefillin, and once they do, by the way, that they become obligated, or once they do, there's really no taking on an obligation on a daily basis, but you can just afford yourself the opportunity to do this mitzvah and glean and gain from it the inspiration that tefillin provides, all these come into action when it comes to the way we approach things. We don't require the same garb for prayer of all women at Or Zeruah. If you notice what some women wear kippot, some women don't wear kippot, some women wear talit, some women don't wear talit. As these are, for women, potential choices that you can really now in our times invoke with a degree of, yes, equality, but you don't have to, quote-unquote, do exactly what the rest of the community is doing in those obligations, because there's still some distinction in life in the physical reality that we recognize within the Kahal, that men and women have a different heritage when it comes from mitzvot, when we talk about mitzvot and the obligations that the tradition required of them. That said, there are communities where women are really creating a very observant way of going about business that also does not require of them to do the acts of prayer or wearing prayer garb or other mitzvot exactly the same way men do. This is the Jofa crowd, mostly the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, who has many, many ways of creating a whole new chapter of halachic history for women in our time. And that is an incredible crowd of very, very respected women thinkers when it comes to doing mitzvot. And so it's an interesting question. You got us on that great track. Oh, you're going to keep us there.
So I have just one question. Because women, going back looking for precedents, Nazarites, will women, I have it in my mind that could a woman become a Nazir?
It doesn't look like it in terms of the Torah, right? We really don't have a Nazirite woman. You have a mother, yeah. But we would have to look a little bit more at the history of the Nazir.
But there's a whole section about...
I'm not as sure that in the Gemara whether or not it comes up at all, the question explicitly.
So let me tell why I think maybe they were allowed, and then you'll correct me because I really don't know. But there's a whole thing about fathers and husbands being allowed to get women out of vows that they make. They have a certain period of time in which to do that. But I, maybe wrongly, maybe...
Yeah, that section is a little bit more about monetary issues and relationship issues.
Okay, I thought that those vows could include Nazirite life.
Not from that section that I think you're thinking about.
Because it's this question of whether or not women can take on obligations.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I need to do a little looking at that question. So we'll circle back around to women and question of the Nazir. Okay. Tracking back to our Beit Hillel Beit Shammai argument. The next part of the Brita is going to invoke this principle that Jay had mentioned about that which comes more frequently versus that which comes less. And it says, Devar Acher, meaning let's make a distinct break from this line of argumentation that the Brita presented before, and let's look at a different possible understanding of the motivation behind Beit Shammai versus Beit Hillel. Birkat HaYayin Tadira, the blessing over wine is relatively frequent. We often bless wine. We bless it not only for Yontif, we bless it for Shabbat. Uvirkat hayom eina tadira. And that specific blessing of Kiddush that's particular to the holiday comes less frequently. And the rule is that when something that comes more frequently, more often, and something that comes less often, you do that which is more often first. So I've taught this principle when it comes to Rosh Chodesh falling on Shabbat. When you greet someone, according to Jewish law, on a Shabbat that's also a Rosh Chodesh, which do you say first? Shabbat Shalom or Chodesh Tov? You say Shabbat Shalom because Tadir v'she'enu Tadir, Tadir Kodem. That which comes more frequently is what you do first. When it comes to, here's the classic example, putting on a talit and putting on tefillin, in the mornings, you put the talis on first, because that comes more frequently. That you can do 7 days a week versus the tefillin, which are only a 6 day a week endeavor, or even less when you've got yontifs around. And for those communities that hold that you don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed like ours, Chol HaMoed. So that is the argumentation, and it says just plainly, the Hilchata Kedivrei Beit Hillel, and the law accords with the opinion of Beit Hillel. The Gemara asks, Mai Devar Acher? What's the need for Beit Hillel to mention that other factor? V'chi Tema, so let's say that you're going to hold that the first reason really doesn't suffice. What was our first reason again? Just to remind ourselves. Hillel says that you recite the blessing over the wine first and afterward recite the blessing over the sanctity of the day because the wine is gorem. The wine causes the Kiddush to be said. In other words, unlocks the solemnity of the day, perhaps, or makes the break, as Barry was suggesting. All right, so maybe the first one, Hatam Tarte V'Hacha Chada. There, in support of Beit Shammai's ruling, two reasons are really adduced, while here, in support of our ruling, we have mentioned only one. Hacha Nami Tarte Ninhu. We shall reply that there are also two reasons for blessing the wine before the blessing of the day. In other words, you gave me two reasons that Shammai might have been right, because the day causes the wine to come, and the day's already been sanctified, and the wine has not yet come to the table, right? Shammai seemed to have two rules. One, the day comes, and then the wine solidifies the deal, and two, this kind of imaginative read that I made, the wine's not yet come to the table. But Shammai's reason over there is that the wine causes the sanctification blessing to be said. That seems like only one reason. Ah, but I'll say, no, there's two. Hachanami tarte ninu. There are really still two reasons over here for Beit Hillel. Tadir v'she'eno tadir, the second reason being that the rule that a frequent ritual and one that is not as frequent, tadir kodem. So that's not a devar acher entirely, like separate and apart from the first part of the Brita. I'm going to match them up. Gemara turns its attention to the final statement of the Brita, which was v'halacha kedivrei Beit Hillel, and the halacha goes with Beit Hillel. Now, when you hear that, perhaps you would recall, says the Gemara, that that's pshita. Pshita, of course. Why do we say of course? You know, because kind of like the Gemara is saying, everybody knows.
Yeah. Taking traditional
Ha Nafik Batko. Everybody remembers that famous sugya in Eruvin, that famous passage in Eruvin, where after 3 years of all kinds of disputes, Beit Hillel students, Beit Shammai students, they're arguing, who's the halacha like and who really gets to decide on the law. And what? A heavenly voice comes, Beit Batkol comes and says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. This Beit Midrash and that Beit Midrash, this teacher and that teacher, both their words are words of the living God. Aval halacha k'beit Hillel. But the law is according to Hillel. Now, that is not a 100% solid principle, even though some people hear that story and think 100%, it's always got to be Hillel. There are, in fact, we could make a nice little study of it, times that Shammai rules over Hillel. Maybe, in fact, I'll bring that one day and we'll look at some of those fun moments where we can say Shammai is really in charge here. I think we had one a couple of years ago in the Beit Midrash. But the reality is that it's a reminder intertextually of that great story, that great sugya that appeared about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai over in that other tractate when this discussion in the Gemara ensues. Now, I want to, well, before we even talk about what the reason is why the Gemara wants to explore this and point you to or remind you about the Greatest Hits album and get you back to that sugya over in Eruvin, there's another great hit that's now queued up. So not only that one, the Gemara goes on and provides another answer. Ebayt Ema Kodim Batkol. But if you want to challenge and you want to say that this discussion about Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai really happened before the ruling of the Batkol,
very interesting
device.
Very interesting.
Called
a
Deus
Ex Machina, I think.
Yeah.
What is the Batkol? The daughter
of
the boy?
The voice of the daughter. In other words, the voice of the Shekhinah. The voice of God that manifests itself in our world, in our realm. It's a godly voice. And again, this is one of those moments where if you want to talk about women's issues and
yeah,
it's a beautiful it's a beautiful feminine word. We can take from that a deep feminine connection. Many do. Let's leave it at that for right now because I want to talk about this passage. So if the challenge is that, of course, this brayta was taught before the heavenly voice declared that the halacha always follows Beit Hillel. The ibaydeim alachar batkol, and if you want to say that the brayta was in fact after the heavenly voice tells you that we have to decide like Beit Hillel, v'Rabbi Yehoshua hi de'amar. But it's consistent with the view of Rabbi Yehoshua who said, Ein mashkichin bevatkol. We don't really pay heed to heavenly voices that come down from Shemayim and tell us what the law is. Meaning, it's in our hands. Lo b'Shemayim hi. A very famous passage, Tanur shel Achnai, one of the ones we love the most in our liberal world of legal Jewish thinking, where the approach to law is that Rabbi Eliezer, who had the support of heaven to say that the oven was pure or impure, that his position was always going to be right, the Batkol comes and ratifies it, the heavenly voice. No, Rabbi Yehoshua calls upon all kinds of witnesses And then in the Beit Midrash they decide, and it's not anymore in heaven. Really, the law is in human hands. Lo b'shamayim hi. And God, even at that point, what? Has such great joy that his children won the fight. Nitzchuni b'nai. They beat me. They won. They argued. They were so sharp. My tatala is just unbelievable. Legal mind, those Jewish people down there in the Beit Midrash, and ultimately we are gifted with that notion that we decide halacha. We decide the law. It can be decided in each generation. We take a lot of license from this, especially in our conservative legal circles, about how we can see the living tradition of Jewish law. And if you look at the note, it comes from the sugya, which is in Bava Metzia, but it's mentioned here. It's mentioned here. And what's important, I think, in terms of asking what's really going on here is, okay, you're starting the Seder, and you have a Beit Shammai way of approaching the Seder, and you have a Beit Hillel way of approaching the Seder, and we have a declaration by this Braita that, in fact, the law accords with the opinion of Hillel. And we have a tradition in one part of the Gemara where a pot coal decides that Beit Hillel is the law. But then we have this tradition in Bava Metzia that says, sorry, pot coal really doesn't get to decide. Right? So why include that intertextual moment? The bat kol in one story, the bat kol in the other. Why include that here, at this Mishnah, at this second Mishnah in the Masechet, at the beginning of the Pesach Seder? What could be the reason why we have this fundamental disagreement and then this moment of Torah from heaven, law in our hands, Torah in our hands, kind of mashup when it comes to the first cup and Kiddush? So I'm going to suggest a couple of things.
The theme for making decisions, not accepting that you already have been done, but to continually engage in on this earth decisions that you're going to have for the rest of the Seder. There's a lot of different things to come. So it may, you know, set the stage for continued debate about things rather than having said the bat kol and then, you know, there's nothing more to discuss.
Right, so I think that that's very much in mind in terms of the rabbinic approach here to how you begin the night and what you remember about the discussion, at least, behind what we're really doing at this moment. Given a certain tradition and given the rules and the legislation, if you will, about creating this Seder evening, never forget that it came on the heels of great discussions and great debates and the most famous of the authorities, and it was essential for the banquet here to not just be recreation of the Pesach drama, but a recreation in some way of Sinai already. And the granting of permission to debate the very revelation, the very foundation of God's relationship with human beings, or the way that human beings would then be able to create the holy community, the holy society that they were asked to create, and that is through the very specifics of ritual law, and then other law, the ethical law that's been enmeshed here or woven in, is to make sure that the poor among you, and everyone's included, both poor and women, in this chapter particularly, and for this event. And so there's great reminders here about what process you're going to use to adjudicate matters within the greater plan of your peoplehood and society. But maybe it's also, and here's the second piece that I want to suggest that the rabbis are bringing forward, that maybe there are certain texts that they want to provide in the build-up of the Seder material here, or the instruction book, that you might consider studying on a Seder night. By the way, those are not in the Haggadah. But neither of those great sugyas are in the Haggadah.
But if I do it Beit Shammai's way, I'm doing it wrong.
Ah, but so that, but that's then...
Or am I? I don't know.
Well, so that's then the question about what license does it really provide? Does debate to the point of some of what might sound like possible outcome, does debate lead to the possibility that I'm doing it incorrectly? And so you have a little bit of space to create custom, and we know that if we look at the history of Jewish law. But we don't just overturn the kind of essential traditions or essential halachot that are codified over ages because we feel a little bit of the license that now it's in our hands. Right? It's a fine line. How much do you take lo b'shamayim hi? It's really not in heaven. It's not Torah mi-Sinai. It's not instruction from Mount Sinai. It's not etched in stone. How much, you know, how much license, how much flexibility do you want within the system? And maybe on Pesach, says the Gemara, by including the sugya, and over here with even the way that Shammai is doing Kiddush, maybe on Pesach, I've got to mix things up in a little bit of a way, or enough of a way, to really create some level of questions about this night and what happens on this night.
My instinct is Pesach is a good time to recalibrate that every year, because it will change from year to year, because the world changes even in the community that stays the same, or the world that surrounds them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that needs to always be recalibrated. Because if everything is ordained in heaven and it's totally static, that is really a problem in a dynamic world. But I think the Seder is the perfect time for that, because as you started out, this is the night of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of questioning intrinsically is one that pushes the limits between those different views.
Yeah. So, you know, the straightforward sense of the Braita, just to this is a response to what you're saying, but a little bit of a different, I think, way. The straightforward sense of the Braita is this, or the discussion after the Braita. Hilchataka Beit Hillel. Okay? The halacha is like Beit Hillel. Ah, so you're going to argue that we don't listen to a bat kol? Right? After we bring up the fact that it was a bat kol who established Hillel's authority? Ah, so bring up this question, we don't listen to a bat kol. Ah, but this was before the bat kol was invoked, right? then it says, but if you want to even say that the Brahmā was taught after the Bat Kol, Rabbi Yehoshua says, we don't listen to a Bat Kol. And therefore, the Brahmā really does need to teach Hilchot HaKaveh Hil.
I would make the distinction, I would have said it somewhat differently. We listen to it because we're interested in what it says, but we don't feel constrained to do it exactly the way we hear it if the world is such that we think we need to do something about it. But we still listen.
Which we mean obey.
But how many
kind of
times
gets into Alex's question, though, at what point is it wrong to do it like Shammai?
And how many times do we get to, yeah, there was a Bat Kol, but we don't listen to the Bat Kol, but we don't listen.
Well,
not listen, that's the wrong word, but the Bat Kol doesn't resolve.
Right. We don't have to say that the Bat Kol establishes the authority.
It's not always appended to the Bat Kol, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Gemara.
So when it happens, it must the circumstances under which it's invoked. Is there a pattern to when it's we get a dispensation from the?
Well, we can look at the times that it's invoked, but these are the two major moments.
Okay.
These are the two major moments. Said another way, this is kind of essential to what will become the rabbinic culture. Halacha is established like Hillel, because the Brahmā says the halacha is established like Hillel. Folks, the Gemara says, don't think that we're following Hillel because the Bat Kol came down and said, follow Beit Hillel. He is a teacher in Israel. He has invoked a serious principle of Jewish law, Tadir v'she'eno tadir, Tadir kodem, the blessing over wine permits me to say the Kiddush. This isn't an issue about heavenly authority being granted by some divine voice. That's just a matter of agada. That's a matter of a midrash. That's a matter of the legends of the Jews. And because we are who we are and value argumentation and value aligning ourselves with new realities as they unfold, and law will be alive and is not in heaven, lo b'shamayimi, we know there will be some room, and we could recalibrate. And Pesach might just be that time every year to do so, because it tells us to ask questions. And it creates space to ask questions about narratives that we take for granted, and even laws that we have established. There is this halachic system. We do have teachers who establish normative law, and we understand that that will create machloket, that will create debate, but we must indeed abide by the law. And it's not because of the heavenly license granted the decisor. And that's a very humanizing statement that Pesach also makes. That there will be miracles and divine voices at this time of the redemption. And you can imagine yourself having been a part of that. But now, you live this earthly existence redeemed from Egypt, and as flexible as it will remain, sometimes you'll have to decide exactly what the law will be. And it's that short of an entry after the second Mishnah, and it's that decisive of a Brahmā, and the halacha is like Beit Hillel. Ruchim to you.
Next question. So a little bit.